Well, greetings, Sun Sounds of Arizona listeners. I'm Roy Weinberg, and this is the Monday, July 20th, 2026 edition of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. This week, I'll start with the From the Editor's column, and then there are two cover stories I'll read. Following that, I'll read Our World, Reporters on the Job, The Explainer, The Home Forum, and the editorials. So getting right into it, the From the Editor's column is entitled, A Modern Epic Where Greece is the Word. This is written by Stephen Humphreys, who's a staff writer. And you can email him at humphreess@csmonitor.com. Andy writes, Christopher Nolan's movie adaptation of The Odyssey features a cast of 5,000 extras. It was filmed in Morocco, Iceland, Italy, Scotland, and, of course, Greece. Every aspect of the production, from ships to costumes, is historically authentic. Well, apart from Odysseus's American accent, we'll let it slide, Matt Damon. Perhaps surprisingly for one of humankind's greatest stories, this is Hollywood's first large-scale production of it. It's an odd gap in movie history, Mr. Nolan told an interviewer. Yet Mr. Nolan's epic arrives at a time when many colleges are ditching classes about Homer, not to mention Virgil, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle. Some ask, why should we bother with the classics? We explore that question in this week's magazine. The centerpiece is a conversation that I convened with three scholars. And for the full conversation, use the QR code on page 31. Well, I'm not going to be reading that article, and I'm not going to look at the code either. But anyway, I digress. We discuss the resurgence of the classics in popular culture, their place in higher education, and why those works face ideological tussles between the left and the right. In a related story, staff writer Emily Staunton reports on young people who are learning ancient Greek to better understand the classics. Film critic Peter Rainier ponders what elements make for successful swords and sandals epics. We've also compiled a guide to reading the classics, including an accessibility entry point for kids. Which takes us back to that central question of why the classics matter. Well, here's one reason. For a young generation accustomed to surface-level scrolling through social media, these ancient scrolls demand a deep dive immersion. One of our panelists, J. Walter Sterling, is president of a university entirely devoted to that endeavor. At St. John's College in Santa Fe, New Mexico, students embark on a great books curriculum. Many students arrive ill-prepared for the rigor it requires, says Mr. Sterling, yet engaging with the classics helps build up essential life skills, including concentration and focus. More than that, the texts invite inquiry and contemplation. Tales such as the Odyssey ask us to explore what constitutes home, why some relationships endure, and how we're all on a quest to better understand ourselves and our true identity. You needn't be a college student to start reading these works. The Odyssey is not just a story for the ages, it's a story for all ages. In the panel discussion, Daniel Mendelsohn, an editor-at-large at the New York Review of Books, said, by looking at these materials, which for whatever reason, three millennia worth of people have thought worth looking at, you're going to get more out of your life. And that was the From the Editor's column, this week written by Stephen Humphreys, who's a staff writer. And it was entitled, A Modern Epic Where Greece is the Word. And now for our first of two cover stories. The first one is entitled, Resilient Odessans Make This Summer a Season of Hope. The port has come out of its worst winter of Russian attacks with redoubled fortitude and a determination to build a better future. This is written by Howard LaFranchi, who is a staff writer. From Odessa, Ukraine, the four-man crew of the CB-90 patrol boat traversing Odessa Bay is on the lookout for the sea mines, sea drones, and Shahed aerial drones that Russia regularly sends towards this Black Sea port city. Russia's aim? To disrupt life and dishearten the population. If we spot a sea mine, we seek permission to shoot at it. If a Shahed's coming in, it might be our guy who fires to take it out. says Serhi, captain of the naval patrolling unit, gesturing with an upward tilt of the head to the seamen manning the boat's machine gun. Noting that his unit's most active patrols generally take place at night, Serhi, his last name was withheld for security reasons, says, "I guess you could say we are the night watchmen for Odessa. But day and night, we are out here doing our part for the port's security and protecting the city's economic life." Surveying the centuries-old city arrayed along the coastline, from the historic center to the port, to the beaches, and upscale apartment buildings to the south, the engineer-turned-naval captain sums up his vessel's purpose. "We're out here every day so that even with the war, Odessa can get on with life." Despite the worst winter since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February 2022, with attacks on civilian infrastructure resulting in scores of deaths, sustained power outages, and destruction of grain silos and other port facilities, Odessa is trying not just to survive, but to progress. Unfortunately, the war reality we are living in has become our new normal life. We have adapted to it, and every day we are working to make life safer and better within this new normality, says Oleksandr Filatov, first deputy mayor of Odessa. At the same time, this effort to adapt quickly to a new reality has led us to think strategically about the Odessa we want to see after the war. Home to the largest port complex in a country that for decades has been one of the world's breadbaskets, Odessa is a key link in the global food security network. In good years, when the war hasn't disrupted harvests or Black Sea shipping, Odessa provides up to half of the grains delivered by the UN World Food Program. The rough winter put a damper on the city's morale, but at the same time, the resilience and determination to persevere that some here call the Odessa spirit is widely on display. That's especially true with the beginning of the summer tourist season, which traditionally sees the city's restaurants and hotels filled. Money to be made. At the beachfront cottage Lanzuron Hotel, contractor Mykola Todorov directs his crew as they repair the building's street-side facade, which was blasted away in a late April drone attack. "I know people talk about an Odessa spirit, and it may be some of that, but honestly, I think it's about making money," says Mr. Todorov. "The owner wouldn't be repairing this if he didn't think he could make up for it over the big summer season. And then for these guys," he adds, gesturing towards his work crew, "it's about putting food on the table." Pieces of drone wing littered the sandy beach along the hotel's seafront, while on the entrance side, a crater marked the spot where a shahed slammed into the ground, blasting out the hotel's windows and glass entrance. "People lost a lot of hope over the winter," says Mr. Todorov, noting that his brother had to sell an apartment to be able to eat. This spring, he says, more of his young male workers stayed home on days they feared they might run into the conscription police. "But then we have rebuilding projects like this that, in a way, are a sign of hope," the contractor says. "This is the owner saying he has faith that people will come to Odessa this summer and he will make money again." The story of Cottage Lanzuron rings true for Oleksandr Babich, an Odessa history buff who ran a city tours agency until he joined the military after Russia's invasion. Odessa was founded by traders going back to the Greeks and the Turks, and throughout history, the motivation for developing a great port here and building a city has been the same, Mr. Babich says. "It's always been about making money." In that way, he says, Odessa is like other European port cities built on commerce. He names Venice, Naples, Marseille, where fortunes were made. In the case of Odessa, it's the grains and seed oils of the Ukrainian steppes that have been the draw. Indeed, if Odessa's port, in reality a complex of three ports, has continued to operate and even thrive amid war, it's because the world's food markets crave the products that ship through it. And because people can make money doing it, says Dmytro Baranov, president of Ukrport, the Association of Ports of Ukraine. "Every day there are 50, 60, 70 vessels waiting to come into our ports despite the risks of a random attack, the high insurance rates, and what might seem like other discouraging factors," he says. The best explanation I can give is that the business is still profitable. And for all the damage and suffering the war has caused for the port and its people, Mr. Barinov says it has also forced the learning of some useful lessons. The war has required a better organization of loading and unloading the vessels, a better overall organization of port activity, even more consideration of worker safety, and better coordination with the Navy on security issues, he says. We've developed a confidence that we can operate in wartime that will serve us even after the war. The Odessa Mama vibe. At the same time, there is a special spirit about Odessa that has allowed it to weather the storm of war better than other cities might have, Mr. Babbitt, the history buff, believes. It's this spirit that explains the flourishing of a district Odessa humor that confronts hardship. Or distinct Odessa humor that confronts hardship with laughter, he says, and which explains Odessa Mama, the term Odessians use to vaunt their city's warm and comforting vibe. Odessa Mama was what greeted visitors coming in at our airport before the full-scale invasion shut it down, he says, but the Odessa Mama spirit didn't disappear during the war. At the white-columned City Hall, just steps from Odessa's signature Beaux Arts Opera House, Deputy Mayor Filatov doesn't try to minimize the struggles of the past winter. Starting from December 12th, we had almost daily attacks on our city until mid-March, he says. Thousands of apartments and hundreds of buildings were without heat and water. Not even one of our power stations was left untouched by the attacks, he adds. More than 300 residential buildings were damaged. But as depressing as Russia's winter onslaught against Odessa was, Mr. Filatov says it also mustered a resolve to carry on and rebuild smart to prepare as much as possible for the next winter. The city has drawn up a resilience plan that includes wrapping repaired electrical stations in anti-drone mesh and providing seed money for residential buildings to install solar panels. Our main task over the coming months will be to help the apartment buildings in our city become as autonomous as possible with alternative means of generating heat and electricity, the deputy mayor says. Grain silos at the ports are being encased in anti-drone grids. Even as Russia's strikes on the city have increased year to year since 2023, new businesses have opened and, perhaps most promising for Mr. Filatov, housing starts over the past 2 years have jumped. The aggregate square footage of new housing units more than doubled since 2024, he says, so that tells you something. Population regrowth. One thing the new housing points to is a recovering population. Before the war, officials bragged about leading a city of more than 1 million residents, Mr. Filatov says. That figure plummeted by several hundred thousand after the 2022 invasion. But a recovery began in 2024, first with an estimated 200,000 displaced Ukrainians moving in from more threatened frontline cities, especially Kherson. Last year, officials started noticing signs that Odessians who had fled were also beginning to return. The result is an estimated population of about 850,000 today. Odessa's historic district even saw a McDonald's open this spring, a short walk from the famous Potemkin stairs that lead to the port. We got some resistance from residents who didn't think it was an appropriate location for a McDonald's, the deputy mayor notes, but we saw in other Europeans that it could be done tastefully, and we see it as a sign of business confidence in Odessa. Dozens of Odessa's new small businesses have been opened by displaced Ukrainians, especially those who came from Kherson, about 130 miles to the east. One of those businesses is Magrest, a company that designs, manufactures, and installs storefront fixtures. The war has uprooted owners Aliona and Oleksandr Kovalchuk twice, first from the now Russian-occupied city of Donetsk, in 2014, when they moved their fledgling business to Kherson, and then in 2022, after 5 months of Russian occupation, made that business almost impossible and prompted several employees to move abroad. The Kovalchuks chose Odessa, and both say they are glad they did. They arrived with their kids and 6 employees, and 4 years later, they've grown to a staff of 18 in production, sales, and accounting. The thing is, we are crazy optimists, and we're finding that fits pretty well in Odessa, says Aliona. For his part, Alexander says they lived through such extreme conditions in both Donetsk and Kherson that the past winter in Odessa didn't seem so difficult. We know it was terrible for a lot of people here, he says, but I also think our past experiences gave us an ability to adapt and left us better prepared to figure out how to overcome the hardships. The couple say that after several years in their new home city, they've decided there really is some truth to the Odessa mama stereotype. Sometimes it can feel like you're getting a hug from your mom, Aliona says. But both say they value at least as much as the other qualities they found in the people, including a flexibility and dynamism. They have a hunch derived from Odessa's history and geography as a sunny southern port city. Walking through one of Magrest's workshops where employees operate laser saws and 3D printers, Alexander says the company's next goal is to expand into producing home office furnishings. We want to continue to grow and give our clients what they need to live and work better, he says. We're finding Odessa to be a good place to do that. And there's a bullet here. It says, Oleksandr Nesalenko supported reporting for this article. And our second cover story is entitled, Space Force Prepares for the Next Frontier of Warfare. Created in 2019, this U.S. military service is already on the front lines of the next generation of battle. A budget boost is set to increase its capabilities. This is written by Anna Maureen Grobe, who is a staff writer. From Buckley Space Force Base and Peterson Space Force Base, Colorado, in June of last year, with the United States and Israel poised to launch massive strikes against Iranian nuclear facilities, troops in America's newest military service, the U.S. Space Force, were preparing for battle. In the short grass prairie of Colorado, electromagnetic warfare specialists pored over satellite signals, looking for signs of adversaries trying to tamper with U.S. military communications. Some of the Guardians, as Space Force troops are known, received firearms training for the first time since boot camp. Then they packed up an arsenal of antennas and headed to the Middle East, ready to jam signals so that B-52 bombers could fly safely to their targets. Many in the military were focused on whether Iran would escalate or de-escalate, says Colonel Garrett Dahlman, who was leading the Space Force Crisis Action Team. But for those in his branch, another big question loomed. How would the Space Force prove its worth? Military culture is forged in large part by waging war, but the Space Force had yet to be battle-tested. Iran was the first conflict that would have active participation from the service President Donald Trump has called My Baby, and which has seen its budget more than double in the past year. In planning for Iran, commanders were confident in what they could contribute to the war effort, but conscious, too, of building a legacy. One of the biggest strategic challenges for the Space Force is not potential adversaries, it's not the pace of change in technology, Colonel Dahlman says. It's telling our story. Growing pains. When President Trump created the Space Force during his first term, there were jokes. The logo, for one, bears a striking resemblance to Star Trek badges. It did not help that actor Steve Carell, in 2020, launched the satirical television series Space Force, as the actual service was standing up. Some Guardians, who add that they still rarely make it through an airport in uniform without being stopped by someone surprised that the Force is not just a Netflix show. It soon became clear, however, that the service was on the front lines of the next generation of warfare, as China and Russia joined the space arms race, and many were eager to join the Space Force for the wonder of working in and with space. When Colonel Dahlman was a child in Juneau, Alaska, for instance, his dad would wake him in the middle of the night to see the northern lights. In 1993, he watched hours of NASA live video of the first Hubble telescope servicing mission. Sounds exciting until you realize it's 4 hours of a guy in a spacesuit turning a wrench, he says. Seeing the Earth spin below the astronauts imbued him with a sense of possibility, one he has retained as he considers the opportunity the Space Force has set has to set an example for the rest of the world on how to extend the American sense of right to this new frontier. And this marvel of exploration often dovetails with Marshall Ames. One of the most striking examples of this came in May with a suggestion from a major security nonprofit that, to win the space race, Guardians should deploy to the moon. The anarchic nature of space habitation, particularly on the moon, dictates that the nation to first secure lunar human presence will be able to set the norms, standards, and legal frameworks to their advantage, wrote retired Space Force Colonel Kyle Pomroy, a former senior fellow at the Mitchell Institute for Aerospace Studies, whose funders include America's largest defense contractors. The prospect of China exercising hard power projection on the moon, he added, is a reasonable extension of China's clear track record of terrestrial territorial expansion through military means. The notion of space wars. Concerns about weaponization of space have been around since the inception of space exploration. Back in 1957, while the world was debating whether it would be acceptable under international law to fly a satellite over another country, Russia launched Sputnik 1. Emitting a steady beep that could be picked up by radios, it alarmed Americans, including Pentagon officials, but also answered the question of satellite overflight, establishing norms that hold to this day. Operation Desert Storm in 1991 was widely considered the first space war, when the Pentagon used satellites to track Iraqi troop movements and navigate with GPS, which at the time was relatively new. Space-based missile warning systems helped U.S. forces quickly detect Iraqi Scud missiles. Satellite photos helped locate hidden Iraqi tanks. In the years since, American military analysts have kept close tabs on the country's competitors as they have made moves to catch up. China last summer completed the first-ever refueling of a satellite in geostationary orbit, more than 22,000 miles above Earth. This is the orbital zone where many of the world's most sensitive satellites, including nuclear command links, are located. Officials in the U.S., which has yet to demonstrate such capabilities, were watching closely because the complex maneuver also means that China could jam, shove, or closely inspect its adversary's satellites now, too. There are also existential scenarios. U.S. Space Command ran a war game in March that involved a Russian nuclear device that could wipe out thousands of U.S. satellites, along with worldwide services such as GPS. It is not hypothetical, analysts argue. In 2024, Biden administration officials warned that Russia was deploying testing technology for such a device, known as a fractional orbital bombardment system. China is pursuing these space weapons as well. And this is where the race comes in. Such weapons are, officials say, in large part a response to concerns that Beijing and Moscow have expressed about the constellation of U.S. satellites. These include those developed with commercial ventures like SpaceX's Starshield, a partnership designed to keep U.S. networks working even if there are attacks against its satellites. An increasingly crowded sky. As other countries have joined Russia and the U.S. in space, congestion and jockeying for orbital slots are on the rise. Over the past 5 years alone, the number of objects in orbit, including satellites and debris, has increased by 600%, according to Space Force officials. In 2007, China blew up one of its own satellites, a move that added an estimated 30% to existing space debris. As congestion grows, so has the challenge entrusted to Space Force Guardians of identifying and tracking any object larger than a basketball. Guardians must keep close tabs on satellite signals as well. It's no small task. Space tools like Bounty Hunter, a system of sensors, software, and antennas that act as celestial detectives, pinpoint the origins of signals that could interfere with, say, communications between commanders and troops. While space operations are a strong point for the high-tech U.S. military, it is also an Achilles heel, as America's adversaries seek out vulnerabilities, says Tech Sergeant Brian Wood, the senior enlisted leader of the 16th Electromagnetic Warfare Squadron, known as Space Delta III. They want to see what they can get away with, he says. To that end, the Force also uses weapons such as the counter-communication system to jam communications. We can say, I want this terrorist leader or this commander to be unable to communicate at this particular time, Colonel Dahlman adds. Commercial opportunities. The telltale giant golf balls at Buckley Space Force Base on the western edge of America's high plains are radar domes designed to protect the sensitive antennas inside. But the ray domes, as they are known, also serve to conceal the direction the antennas are pointing, keeping other nations' spy satellites from gleaning any intelligence about U.S. operations. Here at Buckley, Captain Rebecca Christensen works in satellite communications in Space Delta 8, where Guardians protect classified communications for deployed U.S. forces. While Captain Christensen was a cadet at the U.S. Air Force Academy, the Pentagon started the Space Force, and upon graduation, she became the 35th officer in the force. She's friends with numbers 7 and 8. The captain has not looked back. I get to feel like I'm doing a good thing here, she says. Consider just the commercial opportunities from the force's work. The global space economy, which was $613 billion in 2024, is projected to triple to $1.8 trillion by 2035, notes Colonel Dahlman. And in 2024, more human beings, 20 people, were in space simultaneously than ever before. Those figures, experts say, will only get larger. Beijing's Tiangong Space Station will soon put additional astronauts in orbit. If space tech companies get their way, there could be a single starship with 100 passengers on a tourist flight. This will mean more jobs for the U.S. Space Force to do, such as, say, on-orbit rescues, experts say. And Congress hasn't yet tasked any federal agency with planetary defense, the term for deflecting incoming comets and asteroids. But there are Guardians thinking about that as well. Midnight Hammer. In June of last year, Tehran launched 19 ballistic missiles at Al Udeid Air Base, a U.S. military installation in Qatar. Guardians detected and tracked the fast-moving targets, then handed them off to Patriot Missile Battery forces for shootdown. Officials say this was the largest single Patriot missile launch in U.S. history. It remained a difficult defense, even though Iran provided prior warning to avoid escalating the conflict. Midnight Hammer, the operational name of the U.S. mission to strike Iranian nuclear facilities last summer, was also one of the first really tangible opportunities for a new service to act like a service during a time of battle, says Colonel Dahlman. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, Air Force General Dan Kane, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and President Donald Trump, who created the Space Force in 2019 during his first term, all acknowledged the Guardians' work in Midnight Hammer and, in the months to come, during U.S. operations in Venezuela as well. This praise and some of the details that came with it is also time-honored military strategy. Show your opponents what you can do, and they might be less likely to test limits. Space Force is my baby, President Trump said during a State of the Union address in February. It's becoming so important. The service, in a nod to this, is set to see its budget more than doubled in the White House's latest defense spending proposal, to $71 billion in 2027, up from $31.6 billion in 2026. The money reflects the pace of current operations, officials say, but is also an acknowledgement of Pentagon concerns about the kinds of activities America's adversaries are undertaking in space. Being able to achieve certain effects in space is critical to being able to win future wars, says Colonel Raymond Brushier, who took over for Colonel Dahlman after he retired in November as Director of Current Operations at the Service's Combat Forces Command. And in parentheses, it says, the Space Force changed the name last year from Space Operations Command, or SPOC, avoiding the acronym's Star Trek reference. Space, Colonel Brushier adds, is the ultimate high ground. You are listening to the Christian Science Monitor Weekly with Roy Weinberg on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And now for Our World in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. This is a global news roundup compiled by the Monitor's international team. The first one, China investment rules raise alarm in Hong Kong. China is heightening its crackdown on the flow of wealth from Chinese citizens to other countries, and that is affecting Hong Kong as the key financial hub and destination for much of those investments. In May, Beijing issued new regulations on outbound investment intended to plug loopholes that wealthy Chinese were using to move money outside the nation's strict capital controls, much of it going through Hong Kong. The latest measures centered on illicit stock trading are putting Hong Kong's status as the world's largest cross-border wealth hub at risk, according to the publication Nikkei Asia. And that was written by Anne Scott Tyson. Our next one, a global turning point for mangroves. That's how Zhen Zhang, lead author on a recent study published in the journal Science, describes the rebound of mangrove forests worldwide. Mangroves play an important role in storing carbon and assisting healthy fisheries. But for much of the 20th century, mangroves were destroyed to build structures such as housing or fish farms. Using satellite data, the study found that through restoration efforts, mangroves are recovering in many parts of the world and are even becoming denser in some. Researchers emphasize that continued mangrove protection remains critical. That was written by Whitney Ulick. And our next one, allies' confidence in U.S. plummets. A 36-country survey by the Pew Research Center found steep declines in perceptions of the United States as a global leader and stable model democracy. Marked by strong rejection of President Donald Trump, the survey shows particularly sharp drops in positive views among traditional allies such as Canada. The share of Germans who consider the U.S. a reliable partner fell from 83% 4 years ago to 39% today. Mr. Trump received his highest ratings in the Philippines, Israel, and Nigeria, and lowest ratings in Mexico, Sweden, Turkey, and the occupied West Bank. That was written by Howard LaFranchi. And our last one here is Ska Fela Moya, or Do Not Give Up. That was the Setswana slogan of this year's Comrades Ultramarathon. For decades, runners from around the world have flocked to this grueling 55-mile race, which is run each June between the South African cities of Durban and Pietermaritzburg. This year, more than 18,000 people completed the Comrades within its 12-hour cutoff, including a man dressed as a can of deodorant to raise money for charity, and a woman who jumped rope during the entire route. First organized in 1921, the Comrades is, by a very wide margin, the largest road race in the world, longer than a standard 26.2-mile marathon. That was written by Ryan Lenora Brown. And they say, have an idea for Our World? Please email ourworld@csps.com. If there is an important global story that the media missed, a trend that is driving the news where you live, or a story that uplifts, the Monitor will publish reader picks from time to time. And now for Reporters on the Job in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. This is a map of the world with points indicated on it and then a paragraph about each one. The first one is from Newbury, Massachusetts, and is written by Melanie Stetson Freeman. After 44 years as a photojournalist, I am comfortable photographing almost anything except sports. I do okay with athletes who aren't moving around too much, you know, like golfers. Recently, I had the bright idea to do a photo spread on vintage baseball. My editor mentioned I should get some action shots, knowing that is not my forte. Getting those guys sitting on the bench waiting to bat? No problem. Shots of their old-timey uniforms? Easy peasy. But I missed a million action shots. One secret I picked up, to get a great shot, you need to anticipate where the action will happen. In baseball, that's usually on the bases. In the end, I got a couple. No one knows about all the ones I missed, except you. The next one is from Randolph, Massachusetts. It's written by Kendra Norden Beto. It can be hard to know where to start a story. As I interviewed historian and tailor Henry Cook for an article about recreating 18th century clothing, every anecdote seemed to meander through countless details. It was all interesting, but how should I lead readers through the many nooks and crannies of social history? Sometimes it's daunting to transform pages of research and reporting into an effortless narrative. Later, while reviewing the transcript of the interview, I noticed a detail I had missed. A passing mention of the coat button that inspired Mr. Cook to recreate a soldier's uniform and establish a historical regiment, still in operation 50 years later. It was just the detail I needed, and I was able to stitch together the rest. And our next one is from Oaxaca, Mexico, and it's written by Whitney Ulick. Most people are used to the stress of getting to the airport, but in Oaxaca in early June, on assignment for a story on cocoa production, photographer Alfredo Sosa and I had to navigate our way out. Large protests by a powerful teachers' union were blocking the gates to the airport so that no taxis or cars could enter. Teachers seeking a salary bump in the overturning of a 2007 pension law sat under sunshades and in camping chairs just outside the airport entrance. Others were positioned at a nearby intersection, tangling traffic. Despite the initial confusion, the energy of the protest was upbeat, and it shone a light on Oaxaca's proud reputation for being a bastion of Mexico's social movements. And the last one here is from London. It's written by Scott Peterson. An Iranian I have known for years messaged me soon after U.S.-Israeli attacks on Iran began in February. He could hear the jets, drones, and explosions from his home on Qeshem, an island off the southern coast of Iran, in the Strait of Hormuz. Then, when Iran cut off the internet, his messages stopped. For weeks. When he finally emerged, we exchanged messages and news, which I wrote about in an online piece in June. He described how the war had hammered his community, shuttering some 60 cafes and guest houses on this tourist island and killing two of his friends. After more U.S. strikes, he decided to move back to the relative safety of mainland Iran. He loaded up his belongings, gave thanks for his 9 years there, and left his home, now a battle zone. And now for the explainer in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. And it's entitled, Quantum Computing Promises New Technological Possibilities. How close are they? The U.S. and China are racing to develop computers based on the properties of quantum physics, with implications for science and security. This is written by Donald Coe, who is a staff writer. After fundamentally changing science more than a century ago, modern physics may be about to revolutionize the world of computers, with implications for everything from the speed of doing complex research to nations' vulnerability to cyberattack. Billions of dollars are pouring into quantum computing, a budding field that relies on the sometimes surprising behavior of some atomic particles to process information. The White House has recognized the potential for quantum computing. President Donald Trump, in late June, signed executive orders pushing for the creation of a quantum computer capable of scientific research, use of quantum science by the military, and protections for government computers against quantum cyberattacks by U.S. rivals. If a technological breakthrough comes, wide-ranging implications will likely follow. Quantum computing poses potential benefits for the academic and business worlds, but also raises cybersecurity concerns, as it could be used to crack security codes that protect computers from hacking. It might still take years for current quantum computers to reach an adequate level of development. However, more capital investment and assistance from artificial intelligence have accelerated development. Quantum technology is a really exciting area. It has the potential for major advances, says Stephen Olmschenk, an associate professor at Denison University in Granville, Ohio, who researches atomic physics and quantum information. The path that it takes to get there is not completely clear or how long those things will take, but I think we are definitely on the path to realizing that future. What follows is a question and answer piece. Question, what are quantum computers? Answer, hailed as technology that can compute what's currently impossible, quantum computers are a variation of computers used today. At their core is a quantum processing unit, or QPU, their version of a classical computer's central processing unit. A classical computer stores information as bits, which are either ones or zeros. Quantum computers store information as qubits, which can be ones, zeros, or a combination of both at the same time, called superposition. With superposition, qubits can exist in multiple states at the same time. One can think of it as similar to a coin flip. In our everyday world, when someone flips a coin, it must land on heads or tails. But if this coin were in a state of superposition, the result would be a combination of probabilities that the coin is heads or tails. It wouldn't be just one or the other. This ability of qubits to have multiple states could allow a quantum computer to yield a range of solutions all at once, while a classical computer has to go through each calculation one by one. Outputs in quantum computers also rely on what's known as quantum entanglement, which causes the condition of one qubit to depend on that of another. For instance, if two qubits are entangled and one of them is revealed as heads in the coin toss analogy, we would know the outcome of the other qubit as tails, even before it is revealed. This helps quantum computers explore many possibilities or possible solutions to a problem much more efficiently than classical computers. Creating and maintaining states of superposition and entanglement are the main engineering challenges behind building these computers, as qubits operate on subatomic levels. But once these challenges are overcome, harnessing a network of qubits can yield stunning numbers of outcomes. With 80 qubits linked together, a QPU could do more calculations at once than there are grains of sand on Earth. Question: where does current technology stand? Answer: dozens of companies, including IBM, Google Quantum AI, IonQ, and Quantinuum, have already created quantum computers, but so far none clearly leads in development. There is also more than one way to create quantum computers. Each company uses different elementary particles or methodologies to build these computers, or QPUs, so it is unclear what form future quantum computers might take. Currently, the most advanced quantum computers use anywhere from hundreds of qubits to the low thousands. These machines are delicate and prone to faults. Still, with clever coding, even faulty qubits can be optimized to create a high-performance system. We call that quantum error correction, says Niklas Müller, an assistant professor and researcher at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. That is currently the big frontier. AI models might accelerate the development of quantum computing. They are especially useful for assisting with quantum error correction because AI can help code and pinpoint errors within noisy QPUs much faster than traditional methods. While significant strides have been made, these computers have yet to sufficiently demonstrate full quantum advantage, the ability to deliver savings in resources or achieve higher accuracy compared with classical computing methods. And the final question, what are quantum computing's potential uses? And the final answer, although quantum computing is unlikely to ever fully replace current technology, its implications are varied. Quantum computing could have significant uses in areas such as chemistry and materials science. According to global technology and consulting company IBM, quantum computing is especially helpful in modeling physical systems and discovering patterns and structures in data that might otherwise be missed. That could be useful in sectors from biology to finance. Quantum computing could also be used to optimize supply chains, as it could find efficiencies by sifting quickly through thousands of pathways. But quantum computing could also pose security risks to modern encryption systems. In 1994, mathematicians Peter Shor developed Shor's algorithm, a method that could be used by quantum computers to crack RSA encryption, which secures much of today's online communication. While classical computers would take millions of years to crack a frequently used RSA encryption, quantum computers could do so in just days. To counter this, the United States has spearheaded a post-quantum cryptography initiative, which led to the development of new encryption algorithms expected to be released as standards for civilian and defense networks by 2027. Various parties see quantum computing's potential as evidenced by a recent $10 billion commitment by IBM. The consulting firm McKinsey & Company has predicted the industry will be worth as much as $1.3 trillion by 2035. As with AI and other technology, China and the U.S. are rivals in that development race. China has recently focused more investment in quantum computing and designed the world's first dual-core atomic quantum computer. The Trump administration committed $2 billion to 9 quantum computing firms, which included equity investments through the Commerce Department in late May. Mr. Trump's executive orders in June to accelerate the sector, too, attempt to position the U.S. ahead of China. These computers, however powerful, will likely solve different problems than classical computers solve, Dr. Mueller says. Quantum computing doesn't mean, okay, I'm upgrading my laptop now to a quantum laptop, and you just start to surf the internet, he says. We're solving different problems with quantum computers, and probably some problems that we don't even dare to try to solve right now. And now we're in the home forum of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly, and there's one article, and here it is. On track to ride Amtrak's quiet car. For this traveler, a frantic sprint for a seat leads to a humorous breach of conduct. This is written by Eric Green. There we were, my wife and I, in the middle of a bustling new Monihan train hall, part of the New York City Penn Station complex. We were searching for an advance clue about which track our Amtrak train would be departing from. It was like the last part of that TV game show, The Price is Right, where you needed to guess which box had the best prices. The reason for this monumental decision? I was determined that we line up first to beat the competition to board Amtrak's specially designated quiet car. It is said to have achieved iconic status among the world's passenger train riding population, seeking refuge from the cacophony of modern-day life. In the quiet car, which Amtrak started in 2001, conversations, cell phones, and the playing of music are strictly prohibited. The space is hushed if it's a public library or a church during silent prayer. You could call me the quiet czar, the gatekeeper, if you will, who, if circumstances warrant, always wants to help the folks at Amtrak ensure that the quiet car lives up to its name. That its passengers really must obey the rules, or there could be trouble. I became a quiet car commissar based on previous Amtrak trips, listening for 3 hours and 45 minutes to cell phone conversations, the chitter-chatter between passengers from New York to Washington. Not that people shouldn't ever be allowed to talk, but in the quiet car, Amtrak conductors use a stern, no-nonsense tone when they suggest, "If you want to talk, move to another car." A few moments later, if the disturbance continues, they'll repeat the warning, and by the conductor's rather intimidating intonation, you wouldn't want to know what they'd do with anyone who violates the rule. Philosophers view staying quiet as a powerful tool for achieving peace and personal growth. By obeying the quiet rule in the quiet car, could passengers feel more calm? Or would they depart the train feeling stoic for having been forced to not say anything for so long? They certainly could feel more at peace not having to listen to other people's loud conversations. Who knows, that could translate into the passengers becoming almost speechless about how good they feel about themselves and the world. Amtrak has 21 tracks at this New York station for arrivals and departures. You can only take a wild guess about which track to choose from before boarding crunch time. On this particular morning, I was torn between choosing track 13 or 14 based on where the previous Amtrak trains had departed for Washington. My wife pointed out that a woman with several badges swinging from her neck looked like an official who could help. Rather than standing in the dark, why not ask her to shed a little light on the situation? She looked hassled. Not wanting to make her job more difficult, I approached trying to act cool and collected. At 45 minutes before our train was scheduled to leave, she advised it was too early to know the track number. But she was very willing to help. Stick close by, she said, and when the time came, she'd tell us where to go. People suddenly materialized from all parts of the train hall. After our Amtrak official kindly directed us to Track 5, passengers heading for Washington raced to line up behind us. It's called the bandwagon effect, or herd mentality. They must have figured we knew something they didn't. Then the gate opened. It was a free-for-all race to the quiet car. If we hadn't been in such a hurry, we would have asked our Amtrak friend for her real name to give her 10 out of 10, a 10 out of 10 customer rating satisfaction. As our train was about to leave the station, my wife congratulated me for successfully claiming our seats aboard the quiet car. "I know how much this means to you," she said. I thought she sounded a little sarcastic, implying that I might prefer living in a tyrannical police state. Not letting the comment bother me, I blurted out, "If it hadn't been for that nice lady from Amtrak, who knows what would have happened?" Right then, a fellow sitting across the aisle, who had somehow beaten us in the race to the quiet car, gave me a disapproving stare. He put a finger to his lips and whispered, "Shh." I nodded. You had to admire this guy. Maybe he was even more zealous than I was about the rules of the railroad. If conversing hadn't been absolutely prohibited, I would have apologized. My bad, vowing to never again breach the quiet car code of silence. And finally, we get to the editorials in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. Here's the first one. Living better, not just longer. In an era of information overload, fresh news and concepts can be obscured by slop. But eventually, thought-expanding data and perspectives rise to the surface and into wider public attention. This is the case with a Yale University study on aging in America published in an academic journal in early March. The findings of Aging Redefined, gaining media attention last month, defy and can help redefine long-held and limiting views about the older demographic. Collecting data on some 11,000 participants over a 12-year period, the researchers found that nearly half of American adults aged 65 or older become physically stronger, mentally more acute, or both. If this finding was extrapolated to the entire U.S. population, it would suggest that more than 26 million older persons are experiencing such improvement, the study's authors noted. A key contributing factor to these enhanced abilities? An outlook that counters traditional age beliefs, ingrained theories that equate growing older with growing less capable. Those who held positive expectations of what future years might bring showed better life outcomes. Most people are thinking about aging all wrong, Washington Post columnist Elena S. Wen wrote in June. People need to know that improvement in later life is a common experience. Becca Levy, one of the study's main authors, has previously noted that age stereotypes are absorbed from culture, such as advertisements and social media. By the same token, new information and messaging can help modify or entirely erase such limiting perceptions. And in societies where the share of older citizens is expanding, breaking out of ageist views and modes of thought can be a boon. As the Yale University News Service reported, the authors hope to find their findings will reverse the popular perception that continuous decline is inevitable. More than a century ago, the founder of the Monitor, Mary Baker Eddy, encouraged a similar shift in thought. Instead of measuring or outlining life and its possibilities by solar years, she urged, let us then shape our views of existence into loveliness, freshness, and continuity, rather than into age and blight. Our next editorial is entitled, Hong Kong Mirrors China's Challenges on Trust. Each July marks the anniversary of the end of British rule, not just in the United States, but also halfway around the world, in the Asian territory of Hong Kong. Under the 1997 One Country, Two Systems handover, Hong Kong was to exist as a special region, maintaining a wide range of political freedoms. And many, if not most, Hong Kongers want to hold on to their traditions of democracy and debate. But after several years of tighter control by China's authoritarian government, Hong Kongers are joining forces online with Chinese on the mainland and around the world to protect freedom of thought and speech. China has imposed a sweeping national security law and forcefully put down widespread protests. This year, it sentenced media activist Jimmy Lai to 20 years in prison and arrested owners of two independent bookstores for carrying seditious publications, such as a biography of Mr. Lai and George Orwell's 1984. Meanwhile, the territory's Beijing-backed leader is reading or seeking to burnish the image of the ruling party. He has kicked off a campaign to enhance Hong Kongers' understanding of the significant accomplishments of the ruling party. Innovating for freer expression. The combination of heavy-handed security tactics and info wars hints at Beijing's concerns about dissent. China spends about $200 billion a year on stability maintenance or monitoring of its citizens. But even with artificial intelligence tools, there are limits to what it can do. Between January and April this year, the online China Dissent Monitor documented 1,396 protests. Last August, in the city of Chongqing, large-scale political slogans were projected onto a building. "Freedom is not something bestowed. We must fight to reclaim it," one said. The ingenuity of human expression can still outpace the machine, according to a 2026 report by the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Chinese citizens on Western platforms are shifting from homophones and wordplay to plain language, the report noted. Doing so limits the regime's ability to harvest more data to train its censorship AI system. One social media account operated by Italy-based exile Li Ying is a special concern to Beijing. Its 2 million followers in China regularly feed it fact-checked, uncensored images and videos of daily life through encrypted channels. "My work is about bringing to light the voices of ordinary people," Mr. Li told the Financial Times in May. "The point of my work is to build trust. And for the government that often exercises power by sowing division and distrust among its people, I suppose that is dangerous," he concluded. Well, by looking at the old clock on the wall, I can see that we are at the conclusion of this week's Christian Science Monitor weekly program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Roy Weinberg. Thank you for joining me this week, and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.